Largest Podcast is brought to you by NRJ Media Group. Rich.
Yes.
Shelton Benjamin.
I know.
Is a force both inside and outside of the ring. I mean, we all know him as a wrestling powerhouse, but there's so much more to his story.
So much more to his story, absolutely. From dominating WWE to his insane work ethic. I mean, Shelton is a definition of discipline and dedication.
And you know what? People might not know this, but he's setting his sights on a whole new challenge.
I mean,
we're talking about acting, right? And voice work.
Absolutely.
He's coming for Hollywood, and I have no doubt that he's going to crush it.
Or he's going to crush them. Because that guy is a dude, okay? His journey from amateur wrestling to WWE superstardom, it really is proof that talent can only get you so far. It really is that grit, drive, determination that gets you and keeps you at the top.
What about his behind-the-scenes stories? I mean, they were just so entertaining. Just as like his matches.
Yeah.
Life on the road to what really happens in the world of pro wrestling. I mean, that was like really cool to hear those insider right behind the scenes stuff. And
sure.
Shelton keeps it real. I really love that.
You know what? He does. And he's got a heart of gold. Let me just say this. Whether you're a wrestling fan, a dream chaser, or someone who just needs that serious motivation, do not miss this episode because this one is action-packed and it's inspirational and it's straight up gold.
All right, so let's do this.
Yes, let's get on with it.
Shelton Benjamin is in the house.
He's in the house. Today, we have with us, I'm really excited about this,
yes.
A legend from WWE, Shelton Benjamin.
Yay.
I'm so happy. Shelton. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute honor and pleasure having you here.
Well, thanks for having me. I was looking forward to this, though. So.
Well, we walked in, we saw someone put another door here. I mean, you are huge.
I'm okay.
when you walk into places, do people ask, can I arm wrestle you?
It's happened. It's happened a few times.
I can imagine.
But for the most part, I probably get the stares from people who might go, he looks familiar. A lot of times I look familiar. They can't quite put their finger on it, but like, he looks familiar. And I would say the reason they probably can't quite put their finger on it is because most people remember me when I was blonde. Because for years, one of my most popular runs, I was a blonde.
That's right.
Well, you're much better as a brunette.
Or nor hair, bald. And you recognize that squinty look of like, where is he from?
Oh, I can walk in a room and I instantly recognize it. So it's, and I think most people in the entertainment business, mm-hmm. especially when they've been around a long time, we can tell.
You
can tell.
All right, well, just for the record, no one here is going to offer to arm wrestle you today.
No.
Man, and I worked out twice, in preparation. I was ready.
We do want to know your workout regime, but we'll ask that. We'll get into that a little later. But Shelton, okay, so being in the industry for a long, long time, mm-hmm. you were at WWE for how many years?
I spent a combined 17 years there.
17
I started in 2000, and I went to 2010 before I took a 7-year vacation from WWE. In the meantime, I worked for a lot of other major companies, including mm-hmm. New Japan, Ring of Honor, tons of what we call indie companies, just smaller companies. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, I went back to WWE and did another 7 years there. So I put in a lot of time there.
You have. What got you into it? How did your journey start?
Okay, so she probably doesn't realize this, but my mom got me interested in pro wrestling.
Okay.
Your mother?
My mother.
Oh, I hope because she's listening. Mom. You did good.
Yes, I grew up in South Carolina, and I was raised primarily by my mother, and I have three other siblings. And, on Saturday afternoon, we would turn on TBS or whatever, and we'd be watching pro wrestling on the Superstation. And for me, I never really paid it attention at first. And we're mm-hmm. talking when I was 8, but right around 10 or 11, I think I saw a match and it had Jimmy Superfly Snuka did a flying headbutt on a guy. And as a kid, you know, this was a regular TV match. I didn't understand pay-per-views and everything, but I just saw a grown man jump off of the top of the ropes and land and headbutt a guy in the ring. And I was sold. And since then, I watched religiously. Eventually, it got to the point where I started thinking, I think I can do that.
Aww.
And then I started thinking, I think I can do that better.
What, a flying jump and then hip hop?
Everything. Really? Everything else.
Oh, no. I'm already visualizing you in your living room and setting up. You were actually physically doing them?
Yes. I mean, that's what every kid in my neighborhood is doing. We were making cardboard belts and using aluminum foil to bling them out. You know, it was the time where guys would test out the moves to see if they really work. And I remember the first time one of my friends put the figure four on me because, you know, everything positive and negative you hear about pro wrestling, everyone wants to know is, does it really hurt? And I can tell you from experience, the figure four hurts.
What's a figure four?
A lot. Well, it was a move made famous by Ric Flair.
Yeah.
The Nature Boy Ric Flair. He basically would, you know, put you where you cross your legs like this. He'd have his legs wrapped in it, but because of this position, it's a figure four position.
Okay.
It puts pressure on your knees.
Oh,
on
this, gosh.
Like, everything hurts. For me, the first time it happened, I couldn't tell where the pain was coming from. I just know I wanted him to stop. Like, stop. This is not, and of course, kids don't stop. You know, once you get it on, you gotta crank on a little bit.
They're waiting for your pain. They're waiting for something to crack.
Yeah, exactly. And that move will actually break your leg. So yeah, we were doing all of these moves, and like I said, I just, as I got older, and I got more and more into it, I just like, okay, I don't want to watch this. I want to do this, and it became my passion. And I remember my high school coach, Coach Ron Donnelly, he asked me what I wanted to do when I grow up, basically. Right. And I was like, well, I want to try pro wrestling. And at the time, he actually had gone to school with a famous wrestler named Gorilla Monsoon. Probably most people my age know him from his commentary days, but he's very famous commentator from WWE. And my coach was like, okay, well, he's a friend of mine. I'll give him a call when we get you through college.
Oh, I love that he was saying, pointing you, it doesn't start, it doesn't end here. You're going to continue going.
Oh, yeah, Sidebar, Coach Donnelly, he is like Mike Tyson had custom model, and I always say Ron Donnelly was my custom model because he took, you know, a raw talent who was at risk and basically turned me into a champion. But we'll get more into him later. Yeah. But so fast forward, I get to University of Minnesota where I was on a wrestling scholarship, and one of the first things my coach Jerry Robinson asked me, well, what do you want to do when you are done? Mm-hmm. And I said, I think I want to try pro wrestling. He was like, okay. I know some people in the industry, so when we're done with college, you know, maybe we'll give them a call. Fast forward a couple years later, I'm an assistant coach for the university, and we have a athlete there by the name of Brock Lesnar. Mm-hmm. And Brock got the attention of, well, Brock gets the attention of everybody who sees him. And, of course, WWE saw him, and they approached the university. They actually came to the university first and asked about Brock. And my coach was like, yes, Brock might be interested, but he has another year. So NCAA rules, you can't talk to him.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
We have another guy who is probably more interested. And that guy was me.
That was you.
That was me. Yes. And so that's basically how I got in. But my love of wrestling started when I was in fifth, sixth grade.
So you're at college, and you're going through your scholarship. So this might sound like a stupid question, and I apologize if it does, but what type of training do you need to do? What did you do at the time, or is this something you just learned once you joined WWE?
While I'm in college, I had no idea what kind of training, because I was, you know, for lack of a better term, I was a street performer. Like, I would watch it, I would mimic it, and you know, we just have fun with it. So I actually knew a lot of pro wrestling because I watched so religiously, despite the fact that I wasn't trained. So while I was at Minnesota, no, I never trained for pro wrestling. I trained as an amateur wrestler, which I will go on record as saying is the toughest sport in the world. So I was training for pro wrestling because I, you know, for me to be as successful as I wanted to be, I couldn't focus on where I wanted to get. I had to focus on where I was.
Right.
And amateur wrestling changed my life. University of Minnesota changed my life. They taught me work ethic and all these adversity. So there was no pro wrestling training until I actually did.
Until you actually got
part
of it.
But what was? But you said you were passionate about it. And what was it that you were passionate about? Was it the physicality of wrestling? Was it?
I think for me, the same way people watch a movie and gravitate to certain characters and certain stories and things like that. Growing up in a single household, it also gave me people to look up to. My favorite memories and a lot of, even when I was wrestling, I would always put myself in my favorite wrestler's shoes. For example, as a kid, Sting. Yeah. I was a huge Sting fan. He was in a feud with a guy named Big Van Vader, and Vader is a massive man. And so when I originally started amateur wrestling, like I was a heavyweight, which is the heaviest weight class, but I was about 60 to 70 pounds underweight. Like I
seriously?
Yes. When I started wrestling, I weighed 204.
Okay.
The next lowest class was 190, and I told my coach Raleigh Jackson at the time, if you want me to wrestle, I'm not starving myself. So I'll just wrestle the big guys. And as it turns out, I was pretty good because I ended up being a two-time state champ, high school All-American. And so it was, but because I was always wrestling guys so much bigger than me, it was easy for me to kind of say, oh, I'm staying wrestling Vader, because everybody I wrestled was like, you know, 50, 60 pounds heavier than me. Obviously the action and the violence and the fun, but there was a lot of fun moves. Like my favorite tag team was the Rock and Roll Express. They would do all these really cool acrobatic moves, and it's like, and it was just the excitement of it all. At that point, I wasn't thinking monetary. I wasn't thinking
fame.
I was like, this looks fun, and I like that guy, so I want to be like that guy.
Oh, that's awesome. So you were admiring these guys. You wanted to be them.
Exactly.
And then obviously, it was almost like this magical thing of living through the characters, because
exactly.
The wrestlers, each wrestler has a personality, right?
Absolutely. I can name a list like Sting, Dusty Rhodes, The Undertaker, The Rock and Roll Express, the Steiner Brothers, Rikishi, and the Samoan SWAT team. I love these guys.
Okay, now I have to ask you this question. Do you guys get to choose your own names, or is a name given to you?
A little bit of both, but I think when I originally started, because I was an amateur wrestler from college and, you know, blue chip athlete, it just made more sense for me to just use my real name.
Okay.
So I think I kind of looked out on that. This was just before WWE really got into, you know, IPs, where it's like, okay, this character, we need to own this character. But because of my following that I brought to the table, like, I didn't need to change my name. They added a moniker, but I've always been Shelton Benjamin, so.
It's actually a cool name.
Yeah. It is a cool name.
It's actually a really cool name.
So,
but you know, with the class of guys that I was with, Randy Orton, John Cena, Brock Lesnar, Dave Bautista, you know, these guys.
Dave Bautista as well?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I started with all of these guys.
All right, so let me ask you a question, if I may. Of all of these people, when you join, obviously you're young, excited to be part of something you really want to be part of. Did you have anyone you looked up to, anyone that mentored you when you were there that helped you on your journey?
So when I arrived, there was the only person that I recognized was Jim Cornette. He was a legendary manager. And of course, he was one of the guys in charge. And so I looked up to him, but it was weird because he was also a bad guy. So as a kid, I grew up hating him.
What do you mean he was a bad guy?
His character.
He was a villain.
Oh, his character.
Yeah, he was a manager, so he always managed all these teams. But he was a dastardly villain. Like, you know, he used to run around with a tennis racket and, you know, hit the guys that I loved in the back of the head. So I grew up hating the guy, but then I show up and okay, this is one of the guys that are my mentors. And for me, he's a very polarizing figure to say the least. But for me, he's been nothing but great. So I looked up to him at first, but what I found was once I got there, most of the people, obviously none of us knew where we were going.
Mm.
Myself, Brock, Dave, all these guys, it was like we were just, one, we helped each other, but as far as looking up to anyone, like I think we all still looked up to, you know, the guys who were at that time the top guys, the Stone Cold Steve Austins, the Rocks, the Mankinds, you know, the Hearts. this is what we could get to. Mm-hmm. But again, we all focused on where we were.
Right. And I would imagine as this is what we get to, but going back to the names and the reason I was, because some of them are super clever, mm-hmm. right? And but you also develop personas, mm-hmm. right? Now, do you have a stake in developing that persona, or is that persona given to you?
Both answers, yes.
Okay.
I never took on a comic book style performance.
What were your other names?
No, well, so I've always had monikers, or I was always in a group. So my moniker with WWE was the Gold Standard. When I worked in Japan, my moniker was Invader X. So it was just different.
Invader X.
Yeah, different, because I was like a, for that particular team, I was a surprise guest. And so in Japan, when they don't know who the person is, they just put, you know, say Suzuki Minoru and his partner X.
Oh, got it.
Versus so-and-so. So they don't know who X is. So because obviously in Japan, I'm a foreigner, I was like, I'm an invader. So I was just like, oh, so I'm going to be Invader X.
So you came up with it.
I came up with that.
Okay, cool.
Some are given, some come in with it. So it's like every answer is right. So, you know, there are guys who got really popular as someone else, right. and they just brought that into WWE.
Do you get to decide if you're a good guy or a bad guy?
Sometimes.
Sometimes? Okay.
I mean, when I originally started, I started as a good guy. But then I think it was suggested, while they were still trying to figure out the best way to present me, they tried me out at being a bad guy. And I was just better at it. So surprisingly, I was better at being a bad guy.
That's your alter ego. I know, I was going to say that. It's your alter ego. I think we all want to be better. You're right.
You see the size of it.
You're right. I'll keep my other commentary to myself.
But be polite.
All right. I'll be nice to him.
Please.
But I think the cool thing about pro wrestling is I flip-flop back and forth. But if you ask me which do I prefer, I prefer being a bad guy. And it's for one simple reason. It's so much easier to tick people off than to make them happy.
Oh, that is so true. And ticking people off, I mean, it just makes it better TV, right? And performance.
Oh, it makes it so much more fun.
More drama, right?
Absolutely.
Some guys are so good at being bad guys that the bad guy turns into the good guy because, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin, he's a bad guy. Like, if you look at everything he does, he's a bad guy. But people love him. So because people love him, he's the bad guy that everyone's rooting for.
Right.
So,
right.
The anti-hero. That's
right.
exactly
what it is.
And there are a lot of guys who are able to walk that line because they excel on either side of the fence. But then there are other guys who have never been bad guys, and I don't think it's even possible. Take a guy like Rey Mysterio Jr. Mm-hmm. He wears a mask and, you know, he does a lot of really cool stuff and he's a great person all around. There's no way he can be a bad guy. Like, you can try it, but
people won't believe it. Well, not
people won't accept
because you also get to the fans, the fandom that gets attached, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the following.
Yes.
And that actually starts and builds and adds to your credibility as a character that you start, you know, portraying on TV.
Ray's one of the few people that in real life or in the, you know, far as the fandom, if you're talking bad about Rey Mysterio, there's something wrong with you. That says more about you than Rey.
Seriously.
Absolutely. And I can say the same That's thing funny. About a guy like Kofi Kingston.
Right.
If you're talking bad about that guy, no, that says Kofi, more about you than...
It's on Lauren's shirt.
All of them.
Yeah, exactly. So Lauren from our marketing team has a WrestleMania T-shirt on, and look, she was naming them.
Yeah, there's Rey Mysterio, there's Brock Lesnar,
that's
there's
so cool.
Charlotte Flair, Ric Flair's daughter.
Yeah, and she's
not a fan though.
Not at all.
Hide
it really well.
I know she hides it really well.
So I got a question for you. Mm-hmm. So you get into WWE mm-hmm. and you start your journey. Did they throw you in the ring straight away? Was it? Do you have to go through?
Oh no. So we have what we call developmental. So I signed with WWE in 2000, January 10th, 2000. And I was sent to OVW in Louisville. And OVW is what we call developmental, where all new prospective talents, they're sent to train. right now we have the same thing, but it's called NXT, and it's one big facility in Orlando. When I started, there were a number of different developmental territories. We had OVW in Louisville, one in Memphis. There was one in Cincinnati. I believe there was one in California at some point. Mm-hmm. So you had, you know, pools of talent being sent to all these places, and basically WWE, whenever they were casting a new character or new, you know, situation, like they were, okay, they would kind of decide. But I was in Louisville in developmental for 2.5 years. And that's where I really start. That's when I learned how to get in the ring and how to start doing a lot of the moves and things like that.
So they teach you, like, technique, right? And there's different, like you said, moves, mm-hmm. and you're just kind of training. It's mm-hmm. a training facility.
So they teach you technique, but it's also, OVW was its own independent circuit. So they're teaching us technique, but we're also traveling around, mostly locally, mm-hmm. doing shows. So we're getting experience in front of a crowd. And, like, OVW is, while it is at the time, it was a farming system for WWE, it was its own independent company. So we were actually getting real world experience. It was just at a lower budget.
Right. Oh, and that's great, because you actually get to practice the moves, because it's mm-hmm. not just, it's also working with the audience, right? Because when you're doing shows, you mm-hmm. feed off the audience, right? You have to get the audience excited. So you're doing both.
And to gauge them as well, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, what gets them excited? What gets them to...
Totally.
You know, right. It builds up the crescendo. So it's an amazing way of doing it. What interests me is the training side of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously you're learning your craft
right.
for 2.5 years, but you said you went up. Did you go up in weight to...
When I started wrestling in high school, I weighed 204. The heaviest I ever competed in college, and in college, the weight class is, right now I think it's 286. I never weighed more than 217. So when I signed with WWE, that's about what I weighed. And over time, you know, I gradually, as, you know, mm-hmm. age-related, and just started working out more, and I got a little heavier, but when I debuted, I only weighed maybe 225.
Okay.
So I didn't have a lot of
can I ask uh-huh. now your training regime? What does that entail?
Okay, so
we're gonna take notes.
Okay, so
yeah, Laura, can you write this down?
Now, I will say only recently, and by recently in the last 5-6 years, have really gotten into training, because unfortunately, I was very God gifted. Like, I had muscles and ability and everything that you would think I would have to work for. It just was natural for me, because I played 3 sports. I haven't had an off season since I was 15.
What did you play?
I played football.
Yep.
And then football season overlapped with wrestling season. So there are times when I would go from football practice to wrestling practice.
Two very physical
into the wrestling
things.
Season. From wrestling season, I went into track season, because I ran the track. I ran the 100, 200, and 4x1.
Oh, you were a runner?
Yeah.
What was your best time on the 100?
10-2.
Really? Wow.
I actually took second in states my senior year. I won a junior college national championship in the 100.
Go Shelton. So, all right. So you're very physical.
What did you play? What position did you play in football?
Running back and linebacker.
Okay.
Oh, and then I think I dabbled a little in college, where they were trying to put me at defensive end, but that didn't pan out. But yeah, I was very good at everything.
Oh, so you were that kid that would be like, I'll just try it and then hit a home run, basketball.
Like my athleticism is you know,
nice.
It's really why I'm sitting here today. At the end of track season, well, that was freestyle wrestling season going into the summer. Mm-hmm. So I would just transition right into that. And by the time that's over, okay, it's time to get ready for football again. And that was my high school experience. Once I got to college, it was just wrestling and track my first couple years. From there, I did 2 years there, and then I went to the University of Minnesota, where I did wrestling and track. And then my senior year, like, I kind of dabbled with football, but...
Not really?
Yeah.
Okay.
By that time, I'm a wrestler. Like, I'm... That's where my heart is. That's where my love is. That's where all my best memories are, so... I'm an amateur wrestler through and through.
Aww. So is there a specific type of training you need to do for mm-hmm. wrestling? Because is it a lot of core strength, legs?
It's pretty much everything. And again, I'm speaking as a guy who I didn't work out.
Oh, get out of here.
For years.
Oh, really?
Because I...
Excuse me, why did I throw up?
Yeah, exactly.
And it was
because I want to see what he's made of, actually.
I didn't have to. Like I said, I was always
Shelton.
Active. I was gifted, like, you know, my mom's side of the family were very large people. My dad's side of the family were very thin people. I came out in the middle, so,
like, perfect mix.
Yeah, I was always big enough, I was always strong enough, and I was always way faster than people even expected me to be, because at one point I christened myself the world's fastest heavyweight.
Well, you know, and the thing is, like, when you see strength, you don't necessarily equate that with speed,
mm-hmm.
right? Because yeah. you're strong, but you had both. You have the ability to do both.
Right. Oh, there were sometimes I would, especially with track, because most track guys are long and slender, super muscular, but they don't weigh 200 pounds.
So. No, they don't.
That's a 200-pound express. You got running 100.
Yeah, so.
that's a lot.
It's like a big, it's a big train going really fast yeah. at you.
I've never had a race where the person next to me was as big as me.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But again, I was just fast. So to answer your question, as far as working out goes, yep. with wrestling, like, I didn't do anything special.
Okay.
Like I said, I just stayed active. And once I was into pro wrestling, it was just, like I said, I was always active. I'd work out here and there, but not enough that I would sit here and tell you, oh, I used to... You know, have every day. I would go months without going to a gym.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have to.
All right, Shelton, you're like a superhero already, right? It's like I was expecting the list of Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
When he came in?
I know, exactly. I don't know. He was like a little magic pill or something. I have no idea. So you weren't like on this strict regime of this day, that day, or even food. What about your diet?
Ate whatever I want.
Seriously. Oh,
whatever man. I want. Cake, cookies.
Cake, cookies.
Soda, like. All of that stuff.
Right.
Like I just burned everything.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I hit 42. That's when it was like, that was the first time I go to the gym and like, if I go to the gym, I get the pump and the pump will last me for a couple weeks. One workout will last me a couple weeks. And then I just started noticing 2 days later, I'm like, I don't feel like I worked out at all. I got a little out of shape. I got a little out of shape for what I was used to seeing when I look in the mirror. I was doing a show for a company called Ring of Honor, and they had a woman there taking photos for us.
Mm-hmm.
This is after my WWE experience, where with WWE, everything's top-notch. Photography, food, travel, everything. So when they do photos, they'll edit the photos a bit to, you know, make everyone look really good. Well, now this smaller company, Ring of Honor, and the woman who took the photos, she just took photos and then printed them and handed it. There's no editing and nothing. And we had a autograph session, and she set the stack of photos in front of me. And I remember looking at it, and I went,
oh, no.
And I remember I was sitting there next to my partner, Charlie, and I was like, do you see these? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, is that what I look like? He's like, what? You look great. I'm like, no, I do not. So I signed like three of them, and then I was like, I can't do this. Like, I can't sign these. Like, I'm so embarrassed by how I look in this photo. Like, I took the whole stack and I said, don't sell these to anyone else.
You trashed them?
I trashed them. I left their interview. I left the autograph session, and it was like, with everything I do, I try to put my best foot forward with everything. And when I saw this, I'm like, these photos look horrible. I look horrible, and they look horrible not because of the photographer, but because of the subject. And I was like, I was just looking at myself, and I was embarrassed. So I trashed those photos. I left the autograph. I was there 5 minutes. It was like one of those when I looked down, I can't do this, especially with these. And that's when I got in the gym, and that's when I religiously, 2 weeks later, I looked like a completely different person. And since then, I've become really conscious of what I eat, how often I work out. Like, I train at least 4 days a week for about an hour. I don't eat junk. I don't eat.
What's junk?
I won't eat fast food.
Okay, so you try to stay away from processed food.
I recently had to abandon, like, energy drinks. I don't drink energy drinks.
You're full of sugar, so.
Yeah, they really messed up my sleep process, too, yeah. So. I still eat whatever I want, but I'm very conscious to eat I'll eat whatever I want maybe once a week. And I made the most people, the average person will go, oh, I'm going to eat junk, junk, junk 4 or 5 days a week. Oh, this weekend I'm going to work out and eat a salad.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, that math ain't mathing.
Yeah, the math.
So I just look at that and I flipped it.
Okay.
Because I work out, like I said, at least 4 days a week. I always eat clean. I don't eat a lot of junk. So if I go to a family reunion and there's barbecue and cookies and cake and all, like, I'll gorge myself. Because one day is not going to hurt me because this is one day out of, 30. I flip it to where I don't put myself in a position where I crave this and crave that because I haven't had this in so long. No, I just eat good most of the week and then...
Have like a cheat day. Yeah. Right, but I'm happy that you're saying it now. That you become human now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's something about, would you say it was 42 when you noticed your body changing?
Yes.
Right? And then you're not that young kid anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, good. That's making me feel better.
It happens to us all.
Good.
Since then, like I said, I train at least 4 days a week, sometimes more, rarely less. If I do less than 3 days, then I'm really on myself. Like, no, that's screwing up. So, and it's just, for me, I pick a body part. I go in.
Mm-hmm.
You work it blitz out. That.
All right, yeah. That 1 hour.
Yeah.
Come back the next day. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be here at least 4 times a week. I don't have to try to get it all in because I also don't want to be so stiff, it's just not great for wrestling and my particular style, I'm very athletic and stuff, so I don't want to be too muscular and bulky to where I just look like a robot trying to wrestle.
Yeah. Well, you like the flexibility and everything like you were talking about when you were going back to being that kid.
Mm-hmm.
And going, if we can go back to that kid, right, that was growing up in what was this, the name of the city you said you grew up in?
Orangeburg, South Carolina.
Okay, tell me a little bit how it was growing up there.
Okay, so if we're talking the early days, extremely humble. The first home that I had did not have running water. Oof. So we're talking, we would have to go fill up jugs at the neighbors with water. When I grew up on my father's side of the family, had this huge plot of land where almost every house is a family member, a cousin, second cousin, first cousin, aunt. So there was a lot of, community, but like I said, we were farmers, we were poor. To me, my childhood was okay because, I was just a kid running around the farm and having fun.
You were with family.
Yeah. So later, when we moved more into the city of Orangeburg, it was very small town, urban, primarily black community. I shouldn't say primarily black, but it was my world was primarily black. Yeah. Like, obviously, the schools were mixed and everything else. I would say not bad. Obviously, everyone has their ups and downs, but we had rough times, but I never knew how rough because despite having a very strict mom, she always managed to pull through a force when it counted. And like I said, my dad, while my parents weren't together, my dad was accessible and I didn't spend as much time with him as I want, but he was around.
Mm-hmm.
So I was definitely raised by my mom.
Okay.
Let's make that very clear. But my dad was accessible, and I did spend time with him and his side of the family, which is a lot of kids didn't have that. So I never felt like I was missing out or anything like that. Like, again, it was small, rural. I don't know why I have so much trouble saying.
No, it's a difficult word.
But I grew up like. To make money, I cut lawns to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then the truck would go around. We'd jump on the truck and you would go to a field and you pick peas and go into the fields and pick vegetables and stuff, to be sold at market. We didn't have gangs. We had neighborhood coalitions, what I like to call them. Like, if you're, from the fairgrounds, or you're from the Edisto, or you're from, different parts of the neighborhood is basically, if you were from that part of the neighborhood, that's the gang that was your
affiliation.
Gang affiliation, but we didn't really have gangs. at least not
yeah.
not that
yeah,
I, yeah, yeah. not compared to say LA, right, you know, right, and things
right,
like
right,
that.
Right.
But there was a lot of violence, a lot of drug use, a lot of alcoholics and things like that. I remember at one point there was a club almost across the street from where I live and a block away from where I live. And there were many nights where I would go to sleep to pow, pow.
Oh, you would hear gunshots.
Seriously. Thursday nights and Saturday nights. There was, the one across the street was Thursday. The one up the block was Saturday night. And, yeah, it was pretty common for me to hear a few gunshots here and there. Right. But
and you stayed away from that?
I, through a miracle, and, again, I said I have a very strict mom. Yeah, I never got into it, but also I don't think me personally really ever, once I got an idea of what that life was like, mm-hmm. it was like a no-brainer. I'm not doing that. I'd rather mow lawns. Like, yes, I could go and sell drugs and things like that, but I also would have to look over my shoulder for rivals or people who just want to rob you just sure. to get your right, you know, that, right. that type of stuff. And I had no desire.
Well, and you had a dream, right?
This is even before my dream.
Okay.
Like, I just knew that no matter what I do,
yep.
I don't want to be looking over my shoulder for policemen or anyone with bad intentions.
But that speaks a lot, one, to your character, mm-hmm. and two, to your mother. You know, mm-hmm. because both...
Well, that and my mom would have killed me, but...
it's either
I was trying to be polite. I wasn't really going to go there.
No, it's either the affiliations or mom. Like, yeah. who, you know, where do I go? Yeah.
Mom's going to win that battle.
But that's phenomenal, because that's what kept your family together. Yeah. That's what kept you on the path that ultimately led to where you got to.
Right.
So I've got a couple of questions for you, so I'm going to jump forward now.
Okay.
So you left WWE... And you went, as you say, you went to Japan on the indie circuit.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like coming out of a big machine like WWE and going to something else that was indie or even Japan? I mean, you must have stood out in mm-hmm. Japan. I mean, any foreigner that goes to Japan stands out.
Right.
You know, you are this big, muscly guy that just turns up. You are the invader.
Right.
How was it?
When I originally left WWE, my first major company that I worked with was Ring of Honor. And again, it was humbling. I went straight from college to the biggest pro wrestling company in the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Working with the biggest names in the world. And like you said, it was like everything is like wow and grand. So then when I first went to Ring of Honor, which didn't have a fraction of the budget that WWE has, it was, again, it was humbling. And it was, for me, it was like parts unknown. Luckily for me, my partner, Charlie Haas, he had done the independent scene before his WWE journey. And so he was coaching me because I didn't know how to market myself. I didn't know how to get myself booked. I didn't know if we had an autograph session. I don't know what to sell an 8x10 for. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, right. And so Charlie actually coached me along. But again, it was very humbling. But it also, I think, I needed that experience because it gave me a whole new respect for the business and the people in the business. Because like I said, when you start at the top, you don't see how some people who never make it, the kind of grind mm-hmm. that they're doing and the sacrifices and like the things that they have to deal with and put up with because they've never been to WWE or they didn't have the same star power. I think they call us name guys. If you've been to WWE,
yes.
Most people, if you're into pro wrestling, they know who you are. So you refer to him as, oh, he's a name guy, because fans know them. Well, because of that, I still had privileges and I still got certain treatments that they hadn't gotten because I was seen as a big star from TV who is now doing the indie scene. But also, it also taught me that, I knew I won a lottery ticket, but I didn't know how big of a lottery ticket right. I'd won until I went there. And because I had only done WWE, and once I was there, I only paid attention to WWE. So my thinking was, oh, all the best wrestlers are in WWE. And I went on the internet and I found out, no, that is not the case. The best marketing, the best promotion,
exactly.
like all that, yeah. but the actual best talents... No, they're not in WWE. A lot of them are, they're just biding their time, or WWE just hasn't
They just haven't come up on WWE's radar yet.
Yeah.
A lot of those guys who, when I first started there, are now in WWE, you know, and I'm talking Kevin Owens, Sammy. But there's a whole list of guys who, when I went there, they were still up-and-comers, and now they're superstars. It made me really respect, because what they had to go through to make it to WWE, like, I skipped the line. I had a fast pass, you know, and so it really made me respect all the talent, not just WWE talent, like all talent. It doesn't matter if you're in a show in a parking lot or at, you know,
in
Madison Square Garden, like what they're going through to try to get where I just, like I said, I just got a fast pass to. It's like you have to respect the grind.
Right. And it's a lot of work. Right?
Yes.
And you've been doing it for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But now that, what's next now for Shelton Benjamin?
What
are you brewing?
I am definitely trying to, I want to do some acting. I'd like to.
Acting?
I would definitely like to do some acting.
I can definitely see that.
Yes.
Can you say
with a big smile. I can see it. I can.
I'd get the tickets now.
So there's a lot that WWE did for me, and I can't thank them enough for, like I said, I wouldn't be where I am without WWE. Mm-hmm. But that being said, there are a couple areas where I feel like we could have concentrated on more. A big one of those is just my personality.
Right.
Because people really don't know my personality.
Yeah.
Obviously, they know what they've seen on WWE, but they don't know Shelton, because we never really gave them Shelton.
Yep.
And that's part, you know, obviously I carry a lot of blame for that, because I have to project. And if I'm not projecting, then it's like, okay, we can only do so much. You have to, this is you. No matter what, this is still, you're the product, so you have to. So I take credit for that. And so one of the things I'd like to do, you know, through acting, is just show people, like, I'm more than just a guy who just, just like a mean guy. And because I'm very good at projecting anger. And then a lot of, you know, one of my big critiques that I'm probably going to get forever is just, you know, promos. Like I wasn't good at promos. And to my credit, and to the fans' credit, I wasn't for a long time. But with pro wrestling, and I've explained this before in interviews, like sometimes after you have a certain reputation, doesn't matter if you improve on it or not. Mm-hmm. This is what they believe about you. So this is, you know, where you're stuck, unless the company gets behind you and help.
Right.
You know,
introduce a new side to the personas that everybody loves, right?
Right. But unfortunately, some companies, especially when you're talking about a multi-billion-dollar company, well, we've had you for a few. We don't have time for that. We need someone who can. Mm-hmm. We need results now, and that's not a knock on them. That's why they're the biggest company in the world, because they need results, and so, you know, they probably were less inclined to, you know, give me the opportunities that I was sometimes begging for, but they were still like, well, you know. And I get it. It's, well, we got this guy, like, and I'm just using him as an example, John Cena. Mm-hmm. John Cena's, to me, the best promo in wrestling. Like, if you talk to him.
When you're saying promo, you're talking about, like, talking about.
I'm talking about talking, addressing the fans.
Marketing themselves,
Marketing themselves, connecting with the fans, not stumbling over the words. Cause I use Cena, even though he, like, because he's still, to me, one of the faces of pro wrestling. But he's also from my class, so I take a special,
you know, understand.
But he's always been a guy, like, when he talks, he can win over anybody. Mm. If you put him in any situation, I don't care what it is, it can be as ridiculous or as serious as you, he makes it work. And I remember sitting back and watching him going, how does he do that?
Yeah.
And the one time I really spoke and asked him about it, and, you know, he was like, bro, I just sit. He's like, I'm a nerd. I just sit at home and talk to myself in the mirror. And this is when he said back in OVW, hindsight is always 20/20. When he said that to me, you know, we're talking, this is, you know, 2001 or 2002. Mm-hmm. I'm like, sit and talk to yourself in the mirror. Like, what? And I didn't realize that was a breadcrumb.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I didn't pick up on it.
Yes. Yes.
Later, even Vince McMahon, who was kind of coaching me one time. He was saying, you know, you go and you talk to yourself in the mirror, and you know, and again, I was like, talk to yourself in the mirror. It was like, that was another breadcrumb. when he said it, I got it a little more, but I still wasn't really fully committed to the idea.
The mirror didn't say, Shelton,
right.
Start talking to yourself.
Right. So, yeah. And again, so those again are situations where I dropped the ball. Like,
well, you weren't ready.
All right.
And that's a good point, actually, because you think about it, you've now going to the next chapter in your career, in your life. Okay, you go into that fully with the knowledge of what you've learned, the breadcrumbs that you've now recognized and have picked up. Mm-hmm. And that will help you. Look, things happen to people at different stages in their life.
Right.
It doesn't always have to come at the beginning. You know, we're here for a reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just enjoy every part of it. Now, maybe you'll enjoy it more because you understand it more. You've done more.
Exactly.
Okay. You'll more be more relaxed.
I see your eyes light up when you said acting.
Yeah.
Acting. And so I think your fans are also going to be very curious and wanting to see Shelton Benjamin, not inside the ring anymore, like what he's going to do. So
I'm excited with him. Like it's something I've always wanted to do, but that and voiceovers also.
Okay, like, voiceovers.
Just because, like, I'm a big kid. Like
I can see it in you when you speak.
Like I'm that. Not only am I a big kid, I'm a big geek. Like I went to Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, for the first time a couple weeks ago. And, yeah, I had to give my agent my wallet.
Oh, because you didn't trust yourself?
There's no way. I would have, every cent that I made.
Weren't you there to sign autographs?
I was there to sign.
I would have
used every penny that I made signing autographs to go around buying stuff.
Oh, like, you're going to have to show us some of your collections later.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. One is like, oh, is that a grown man? Why are you like,
but we
no,
all have
no,
that
I'm
in
a big
us.
Kid.
We all, you know, we're a big kid.
Yeah.
Well, acting will definitely help you be that big kid and the voiceover work as well. So you're going to exercise all these other things. And going back to what you said, Rich, sometimes when we don't listen to those voice, but then we finally do it, it's sometimes it's even better because you do it with that much more intensity, which that much more purpose. And drive, because you didn't have it. You were curious about it.
Right.
And you're going to do the work to get there, too, right?
Right.
Because it takes work.
For me, and this is just me knowing myself, I have to be in a must-do situation.
Right.
For example, when I went to college, I went from small-town Orangeburg, South Carolina, to small-town Susanville, California, on the other side of the country. You know, it was complete culture shock.
Yeah.
But I flew there on a one-way ticket.
Yeah.
And the reason I chose California in the first place, and I think we spoke about this before, is because I had watched in my hometown people graduate, go to college in Atlanta or Florida or, you know, sometimes even in New York, get homesick, come back home, and really, I don't want to say they gave up because obviously I don't know where it went, but the fact that they quit school just to come back home because... Oh, it was just easier just to come back home. Yeah. Things got hard. I'm just going to go home.
You took that way.
Yeah, I had, when I moved to California, I had $5 in my pocket and a trunk full of all of my belongings that was some clothes and a few cassette tapes.
Your comic book series in there too?
Oh, yeah, everything. So, but everything I owned fit into a little trunk that I could carry in a bag. And when I went to California, it was like I was in a situation where, okay, this has to work.
Yeah.
Because I don't have the money to get back home.
Yes.
So this has to work. When I went to the University of Minnesota, same situation. Like, these people are paying for me to go to school.
Right.
You know, I'm doing good in college, but no matter what, this has to work.
Yeah.
When I finally got signed with WWE, like, and I remember talking to my best friend Troy at the time, and I was like, I know if I get in, I'll do well. I just need a shot. I got that shot. And then while I was there, and mind you, I just became a new father. My daughter was born in 99. So again, I was in a situation where I'm out of college, but I'm still broke. And so now I have this opportunity with WWE, and I have a newborn daughter. And so my thing is, this
has to work.
Yes. So now with acting and you know, a lot of my ventures that I want to get into, like, I'm on the clock now. Like, this stuff has to work. Like, I don't have time to, I wonder or I hope or,
no,
you know what I mean?
Happen.
Or I try to pick up the breadcrumbs as soon as I see them. If I hear, you know, nice. If I hear something profound, or even if it sounds strange to me, I try to pick up on it as soon as possible, because I need, like I said, I'm on the clock. This has to work.
Yeah.
If you build it, they will come.
They will.
Look, everything you've done in your life has been with drive and with purpose, from what you've explained to us. So it's only going to follow through. And one thing I've noticed, as you go further into your life, knowing the end is getting a little bit closer, that drive and purpose gets more and more. It doesn't diminish.
Right.
Because you know there's still things that you want to do, and there's still things that you want to achieve.
Absolutely.
With less time to do it in.
And you've accomplished it. You have a history already.
Exactly.
Like, this got to work. Yeah, it worked. So this is how we do it.
Work
on the next one.
Look, what I would say to you is, I would finish by saying this. You know, you mentioned before about people only know your persona. I hope after listening to this, they understand who Shelton Benjamin really is. The man behind the myth, you know, because...
I love that.
You are honestly, look, we've met once before. It's a pleasure listening to you, talking to you, hearing what you have to say. It really is, because you're a good person. You radiate a lot of good energy. And we both wish you every success. And when you're on your first film, can we be extras?
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to have them back, for the project that you're going to take on. Yeah. And I'm sure you're going to get a lot of projects because you have quite a big persona. And I think you owe it to your fans to see that and see how that develops into other areas, Shelton.
Now, we finish, with asking our guests to pick a card, one of the cards that's sitting next to you, any card.
Yeah.
They're quite deep questions.
Yes.
Okay.
So, choose wisely.
Yes, but be prepared.
Okay.
So read the question out, if you wouldn't mind answering it, and then Norma and I will answer as well.
Yeah, and do read it out loud so everyone can hear.
Okay, so...
Which one? Any card.
So just out of curiosity, is the intensity of the seriousness of the question based on the color?
The
I'm actually colorblind, so I couldn't tell you.
Oh, that's right. You are colorblind, huh?
Okay, well, I'm going to go right for the middle and see what pops up.
All right.
They actually end up being quite poignant, some of these questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, what's a deal breaker for you in a relationship? Ooh.
Oh.
Ooh.
That is deep.
Ooh, that is...
A deal breaker.
A deal breaker.
And it could be any type of relationship. Business relationship, right? Personal relationship, yeah.
Okay.
Just one?
I'm going to keep... It's real basic, and it's very comprehensive answer. A comprehensive answer for any situation. If there's lack of trust, there is no relationship.
Oh my God, you took quite a while. I have to come up with something else.
Can you get out of my head?
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty much the, if I don't trust, if you can't trust, if you can't develop a trust.
Yep.
And sometimes trust can be broken and fixed, you know, things happen.
Right.
But once there is no trust, there is no relationship. And
that's so true. Yeah.
That's the deal breaker.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I have an alternative. You're going to have to bleep this. Don't be an asshole. Asshole personalities, that's a deal breaker for me. You're undone. And it could be, and I think a lot of it stems for, especially in the industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's ego, because it's ego-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say that's changing. We're trying to change that with this podcast, right? And bringing more positivity, inspiration, and collaboration. But definitely someone's attitude. If their ego is like front and center, that's a deal breaker for me.
Mm. It's so much so that when we first started this...
Oh, no, you're going to share this story?
Norma said to me, we were on a call, she said, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. She goes...
I didn't know yet this time.
No, right? Clearly. Yeah. She said to me, promise you one thing. I said, yeah. She goes, when we become successful, you won't be an asshole. And I said, no, of course I won't.
that stumped you, too.
You did, actually. It was the last thing I thought you'd turn around and say. No, I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. But I, from what you said, I mean, trust and honesty are absolutely key in my personal and my business life.
Right.
You know, it absolutely, in any part of my life.
That was comprehensive. It covers every
it
aspect
covers
of life.
Grounds,
yeah. It does. Look, I hope that I go through my life and I'm always open and honest and I'm trustworthy, and that's because that's what I trade on.
Yeah.
Okay, we were talking about this yesterday, just very briefly. There's an expression, Shem Tov, which means good name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and your good name is what you trade with. Doesn't matter who you are or where you are in your life or what you're trading it in.
you need a good name.
Yeah.
And that's so important. So, and the only way you get that is with trust and with being honest.
All right.
So I agree.
I did a podcast previously with Chris Van Vliet, and I was explaining to him, because so I don't know if you guys noticed, I'm known for ladder matches. And that's where you actually climb ladders, fall off ladders, fall through ladders. And one of the questions was, how did it feel to fall through a ladder? And I remember my answer was something along the effects of going through the ladder was a piece of cake, but, you know, this only this part hurt, but it wasn't going through the ladder. And, you know, I read the comments, and I remember a fan was like, BS, like, you're lying. You're like, you know, you went through a ladder, didn't hurt, BS. And I was like, show me where I have ever lied before. You think I'm going to start now? So it's like, I try to be as genuine and as honest as I can, especially when a camera's rolling. Like, sure. I'm.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know.
Because you're a role people, model. You're a role model.
I'm a role
kids
model.
Watching,
people
right?
keep receipts. Like, I'm very conscious.
People keep receipts.
Yeah. I'm very conscious of stuff I say because I don't want to look like a. Like you said, like a lying jerk. I'm not going to say something to make myself look better.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I try to be as honest as possible. Right. If I think something's going to make me look bad, well, I'll try to just get away from that, sure. that particular right. question. But right. I'm a real, especially with my fans, I'm really, yes. really honest. And again, if there's something I'm uncomfortable with, I just want to address it. And like you said, your podcast is about promoting positivity and, you know, things like that. And I'm big on positivity. I'm big on respect. I try to be positive in the worst of situations, and I try to respect everybody until you disrespect me.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's when you get
and
the
that's
horns.
Fair.
But,
yeah.
and that's that, fair. But that's fair. I really do try to promote just like you guys. Even though I'm a bad guy.
Yeah.
I try to be a good guy.
There's a good, yeah, exactly.
I try to be as positive a person as I can. And a lot of times that can be taken advantage of, you know, to my point. Sometimes you have to, sometimes the lion has to roar to remind people, yo, I'm a lion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally. Yeah, I might be a sleepy lion, but I'm still a lion.
Yeah.
So,
Just finish with this. I mean, I've loved boxing most of my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a boxer. I like to box. And I use it in my day-to-day life, and it's like you keep your guard up. You know, you go through, you go into something, and mm-hmm. it's coming towards you, you block it, you parry. But when you get that opening, that's when you roar. That's when you roar.
Speaking of punches, is there one last piece of advice? This is at the end of our show, mm-hmm. that we like to have our guests speak to our audience members and our listeners, that you would like to share words of wisdom, parting words, a mantra that maybe that you live by?
Please and thank you. Oh. Please and thank you have opened more doors for me than any other thing in my life. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter who you're with, who they are, where they are economically, racially, like, please and thank you. And I'm basically saying just always be respectful. Because you never know. You never know who you're talking to. You never know what doors open or close with it. My best friend, MVP, like, obviously in our lifestyle, people ask for autographs all the time. And MVP, and he's very big on please and thank you. And you know, this is actually something I learned from him, because he spent time in prison, and, you know, he's open about that. And he talks about it. He, for 10 years, he lived a life of constantly being told what to do extremely rudely. And so now, whenever, he's a superstar now. So when people ask him for autographs, he'll give anybody an autograph. But as soon as they ask, he'll, like, if they don't say please, he'll give them a chance. What is it?
He's like, follow up.
See, like, he's waiting on the please.
Yeah.
Because sometimes fans do kind of just, they get ahead of themselves.
Sure.
So he forces, he gives you an opportunity.
He'll educate you. Yeah.
But but if he doesn't get the please, he'll just walk off. Mm-hmm. He won't be rude about it. He'll just, okay, never mind. No. And walk off. And it's just, please and thank you. Do the same things you learn in kindergarten. Right. Be polite to people. Be courteous to people. Even when you don't like them, it's like, show respect to everybody. Before I go, just one other little thing I learned from from the most unlikely of sources, you know, in my opinion, a guy named Tony Atlas. Tony Atlas is a wrestler. He was really popular in the 80s. Has a creative life. He ended up being homeless at one point. And, you know, he got his life back together. And he was talking to me. Now, mind you, Tony is sometimes his worst enemy, in my opinion. But one thing I learned from him was he was saying, you see how you guys go through these hotels and how you're always, you mess up a room. Mm-hmm. And then these women have to, you know, women and men have to go and clean their rooms. And you look down on him, you talk to him. He's like, he doesn't look down on people in those positions. He's like, because they're people too. He's like, I spent years invisible. We're like, what are you talking about? He's like, I was homeless. So I'd be standing on the side of the street with my hand out and no one saw me. Oh. And I was like, oh, okay. So that for me was a lesson to, and it was also a mirror because I'm like, you know, he's right. Because there were times I'd go into like a restaurant, you don't respect the waiter. You don't respect the valet. You don't respect the maid that's cleaning your room because they're not in the same position socially or economically as you. And it's like, no, we're all people. We all come from the same place. We're all going to the same place. So try to show respect to everyone.
Right. So, well, Shelton, please come back.
Please do. It's been amazing having you on.
Thank you for being here. Yeah, thank you.
Honestly, what you just said is so lovely. Please and thank you is costing nothing. Doesn't matter where you're on the social scale.
It's
lovely. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Shelton.
Well, thanks for having me.
But please be back. You're going to be back.
Oh, I will definitely be back.
I want you to talk about some of your projects that you're going to undertake.
Oh, yeah.
So please be back.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And cut.
Thank you for tuning in to Energist Podcast, where ambition meets achievement. If today's stories energized you, share this episode with someone who needs that spark. Stay connected. Subscribe to our newsletter at nrjmediagroup.com and follow us on social media for more powerful insights. Until next time, stay inspired, stay bold, and keep striving for greatness.
Energist Podcast is produced and hosted by Norma Garcia and Rich Reed. The incredible talent behind us. We are highly engineered and edited by Rich Evers. Our seriously created director is none other than David H. Tanaka. Our talented music composer is Steve Devaney. Our devotion to motion graphic designer is Mike Macklin. Our very spirited technical advisor is Tracy Williams. Our amazing marketing manager, Lauren Carter. Our man of many words publicist is Josh Gershman. And introducing our producer's assistant, Blake Mealy. Energist Podcast is brought to you by NRJ Media Group.